1. Introduction. Because there is language, there is poetry. It's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring. He went to bed with a bucket on his head and couldn't get up in the morning. Children as young as 2 or 3 can delight in this rhyme and will try to get their own tongues round it. Why is this? Most simply, it is because they delight in the noise it makes. Just at the time they are sorting words from their whole acoustic world and beginning to use them themselves, here is a piece of language they can understand and whose sounds give them immediate pleasure. Exploring how this works in more detail, I think we can recognize several particular features in its short span. First, it has strong, obvious beats. It's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring. He went to bed with a bucket on his head and couldn't get up in the morning. Moreover, there is an intriguing change of pattern within the first 4 lines. 2 strong beats occupy only 4 syllables in line 3, as against the 6 or 7 of the other lines. Then, in the last line, there are 3 stresses. Line 4, with a bucket on his head, seems to present a difficulty as the speaker has to scramble over with a to get to the next obviously stressed syllable, bucket. Indeed, another version of the rhyme goes, he got into bed and bumped his head, which is simpler to say because it is more regular. And if we combine the two to read, he went to bed and bumped his head, it would be more rigidly patterned still. However, the pleasures of verse don't come from rigidity, but often from a flexing of a basic scheme, and the difficulty of articulating lines 3 and 4 presents the same kind of enjoyable challenge as a tongue twister does. If the game is to recite it ever faster, the fun increases, until the inevitable hilarious breakdown. However arrived at, it is the not-so-simple irregularities of this simple rhyme that account for its rhythmic pleasure. At the same time, this little verse is dominated by clear rhymes: raining, pouring, snoring, morning, and bed, head. Standing out from the more normal rhythms and sounds of speech, this verse encourages a physical response, like clapping or swaying, just as modern pop songs do. The importance of the tune always makes it very difficult to compare poetry and song lyrics. But in the words of the ABBA song Mamma Mia, for instance, we can broadly see rhythm, rhyme, repetition of word sound, including internal rhyme, and phrase deployed in just the same way as part of the pleasure. It is just those qualities which make the rhyme a favourite with children well before they make any more sense of the emotional meaning than they can of why a man might go to bed with a bucket on his head. Rhymes such as these, and even simpler ones, like the first lullabies, are among the earliest utterances we address to children, because we know they will respond to these effects. Through evolution, the human vocal tract has become able to give voice to a variety of particular sounds and their complex combinations. With these, we have created languages which can communicate information of very different kinds and to a very high degree of subtlety. As we acquire language, we make and respond to sounds, imitating and relishing them, before we learn the particular ones that go to make up words and discover how effectively word sounds denote objects in our world and carry information to others. However sophisticated our utterances become, the sensuous character of language remains. Many poets have made the same claim. Gordon Bottomley, 1874 to 1948, was among the most emphatic as he resorted to capitals to insist that the sound of poetry is part of its meaning. As the poet Kenneth Coke, 1925 to 2002, writes, each word has a little music of its own. which he goes on to say, poetry arranges so it can be heard. Coke, 1998, page 28. A clock in the eye ticks in the eye a clock, ticks in the eye. A number with that and large as a hat, which makes rims think quicker than I. A clock in the eye ticks in the eye a clock, ticks, ticks in the eye. As we have seen with the rhyme and the song chorus, the music of words is further enjoyed in such sequences as a run of the same consonants, alliteration, rhyme, or the repetition of certain words, or rhythmic patterns. These lines by Gertrude Stein, 1874 to 1946, show this kind of fascination. Now, the intrigue extends to the surprising juxtaposition of word meanings, as does the title of the poem itself. Before the flowers of friendship faded. Stein called her book Tender Buttons. Ponder for a moment what associations come with putting the words tender and button next to each other. These resources of language, especially recurrence, the anticipated pleasure of a sound or shape being repeated, have been used in the pre-literate oral tradition of all societies for dances, riddles, spells, prayers, games, stories, and histories. The work of the American poet or researcher Jerome Rothenberg, 1931 to date, provides a wealth of examples of this from every continent and many cultures. We should not assume, though, that work of this kind from pre-literate cultures is simple. Often, as Ruth Finnegan shows in her anthology Oral Poetry, work such as the Malay form of the Bantun, which we will meet in its English adaptation in Chapter 7 on stanza, can be very elaborate. More familiarly, the early enthusiasm for nursery rhymes, chants, schoolyard games, songs, advertising slogans, and jingles all feature the same kind of gestural characteristics. Gesture is an important concept here. What I mean by gesture in language are those qualities we employ to signal our meaning strongly by emphasizing particular word sounds, rhythmic sequences or patterns, such as those we have recognized in the previous pieces. Thus, the words will catch our attention not only through a grasp of their dictionary meanings, but also through their sensuous impression, not unlike, indeed, the way we accompany speech by hand gestures and variations of tone, the incantatory musical qualities of beat, drum, and dance are close to this and are part of the close relation between poetry and song. Indeed, the term which is still key to both, lyric, points to this connection. Lyric refers to that kind of verse most readily associated with the chanting or sung origins of poetry, traditionally to the harp-like stringed instrument known as the lyre. We still refer to the words of song of all kinds as lyrics, and poetry that is closest in style and span to songs, as opposed to poems that tell substantial stories or are the medium for drama, are defined as lyric. I shall have more to say about this genre of poetry in Chapter 3, Tones of Voice. In poetry without music, these qualities have become formalized into what are its most prominent distinguishing features, its rhythms. That is, the way a sequence of words moves in the ear, and its meters, that is, the regular patterning of such movements into the poetic line. The character of the many different kinds of poetic line will be explored in separate chapters. So, while the evolution and use of language has obviously been functional, exchanging information with the necessary clarity, its sounds and shapings, both spoken and written, are also inevitably gestural. Of course, these instrumental uses of language We'll be as simple and direct as possible, like the bald instructions for using a computer. Press enter, select the file to be moved, double-click the mouse icon. But even the specialized language associated with computers is not literal, but metaphorical. The mouse, Windows, desktop, and bin. My computer manual promises right answers right now. And the simple emphasis of this punchy phrase, repeating right, is the kind of language I am calling gestural. This snatch of a conversation is invented, but I think it is recognizable. So I have to go to the bank. No sign of it there. Back to the butcher's. No sign of it there. Back to the chemist. No sign of it there. Back to the deli. No sign. Back to the cafe. No sign. Where was it? Slap bang in the middle of the kitchen table. The speaker wants to express tedium and exasperation at mislaying a purse, and these repetitive, truncated phrases, with their slight variations, impress this upon the listener. These are the gestural features of language. So the argument of this chapter is that poetry is not really a peculiar, demarcated zone out of the mainstream of language use, but that language is inevitably and intrinsically poetic in the qualities that I'm calling gestural. However, historically, these qualities have been highlighted and formalized for particular uses and occasions. Poetry is a form for special attention, and one that calls unusual attention to the way it is formed. The ancient ceremonial aspect of gestural language persists in our desire for special forms of language for particular occasions. We all know, for instance, how difficult it is to find words of condolence. In greeting cards, at weddings, funerals, in sorrow and commemoration, and in love. Wherever we feel the need for heightened, deliberate speech. Wherever there is a need for something to be said. We turn to the unusual shapes and sounds of poetry. This is also why we might be drawn to write poetry in order to form an utterance that is out of the ordinary and commensurate to the weight or the joy of the occasion. Always at such times, we will encounter the familiar difficulty of finding what we know to be the right words. The deployment of impressive sounds and shapes, the deliberate speech required by that something to be said, has been known in the Western tradition as rhetoric. In this emphasis, from Paradise Lost to a local newspaper's In Memoriam verses, poetry can be seen to be a part of rhetoric. However, every experience with language teaches us that communication is frequently less transparent than we would wish. Disappointment at the failure of language to be clear, and at its capacity to mislead and sway us into deception, has marked our thinking about language for centuries. Ambiguity, double meanings, equivocation, intended and not intended, all manner of speaks, double speak, media speak, result from or exploit the potential anarchy of language. Often, it seems, words run away with themselves and take us with them. This may lead into a cheerful gallimaufry of free association and wordplay, or into saying things we did not mean. Those right words can be very elusive. As a form of utterance that is especially sensitive to all the various resources of language in both its semantic, i.e. meaningful, and its sensuous dimensions, poetry has taken upon itself the freedom and opportunity for wordplay, and also its responsibilities. Because language is, as it is, we might say anything. Because life is how it is, we need to watch what we say. Through language, we can not only convey common information, but also achieve a vast capacity to generalize particulars and to abstract from experience. We can also invent and fantasize, and relay any of this to others. Its immeasurable creative flexibility enables an enormous range of associations and communications. So, since the nature of language itself does not necessarily oblige us to be purpose-like, it also enables associations which may seem purposeless. It is often irresistible, even just for the hell of it, to remove its use as far as possible from any externally driven direction. The philosopher, Daniel Dennett, observes the essential biological function of language in evolution, but continues, "Once it has arrived on the evolutionary scene, the endowment for language makes room for all manner of biologically trivial or irrelevant or baroque, non-functional endeavors. Gossip, riddles, poetry, philosophy." Dennett, 1984, page 48. On this view, all poetry, including the most rhetorically purposeful, might be seen as baroque, perhaps trivial or irrelevant. And we shall look at the philosophical problems surrounding rhetoric and figurative language in Chapter 8. But when the owl and the pussycat go to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat, then we can see that language can indeed promote those endless associations in ways that seem especially baroque and delightful. So, language can be deployed uselessly, and an alternative emphasis to the rhetorical one would see poetry as the space where the glory and freedom of the possibility to say anything is specialized. An orange the size of a melon rolling slowly across the field where I sit at the center in an upright coffin of 5 panes of glass. Such a relish as this, from Tom Raworth's 1938-2017 poem, Now the Pink Stripes, may be inspired by a desire to explore the light-spirited freedom afforded by language, in a space not subject to instrumental demands. There can be a sheer game-playing element in such poetry, a love of messing with words because we can. Alternatively, or in addition, it may be a response to a disillusionment with the use of language in the real world of affairs, transactions and information. This doubt as to whether language really does simply transport common sense from one person to another is deep and long-lived. In William Shakespeare's 1564-1616 Twelfth Night, the clown Fest complains that language has been so much discredited by being used to lie and deceive, that words are grown so false I am loath to prove reason with them. Fest claims here that the character of social discourse has become so unreliable that language itself has become discredited. Beginning in the 1970s, the American language poets have taken a similar view. This appellation, which comes from the title of one of the principled journals associated with the movement, draws attention to language as itself a material, rather than an invisible medium through which we make meaning or express ourselves. They question the whole idea of poetry as personal expression of experience, ideas, or emotions, but focus instead upon the features of words as objects in themselves. Further, they challenge the dominance of what Charles Bernstein, 1950 to date, calls the authoritative plain style of modern industrialized, business-oriented society, its increasing standardization claims a monopoly over coherence, and eludes tones and styles of speaking and writing that do not conform to mannered and refined speaking. How Bernstein and other writers associated with this point of view respond in their own poetic practice will be explored in Chapter 9, Writing a Poem Now. All of these pleasures and problems are with us because of the character of human language. What we have come to call poetry gives us a structured, deliberate space in which to enjoy and to tussle with the experience of language. Reading or writing a poem offers a practicing awareness of the problems of language and meaning, specifically, of what we must say and how we can best say it. Because there is language, there is poetry. In the rest of this book, I shall try to send out some of the principal ways that poetry in the modern English language has been made across the whole spectrum of rhetoric and nonsense. Summary. In this introductory chapter, we have looked at the character of human language, especially with regard to its sounds, the pleasure of rhythm and rhyme from children's verses onwards, how language operates functionally, uses gesture, and can also work uselessly and enjoyably, the problem of finding the right words, the basic idea of rhetoric and the challenge of nonsense, the continuity between the general use of language and poetry, and its distinctiveness.